Yes, check, check. We are recording. It is all going. Okay,
good.
So I'm going to start with the introduction. So my name is Miriam Johnson. The date is July 16th, 2012. We are at 317 Allen Street at the Inn at Hudson. This interview is part of the Oral History Summer School Hudson City Archive Project, and I'm here with Wendell Davis. Wendell, could you please introduce yourself?
I am Wendell Davis.
Fantastic.
Here on a hot summer day.
Isn't that the truth? Definitely the middle of July. So, Wendell, could you please tell me a little bit about where you come from?
Sure. I actually grew up in Syracuse, New York, just west of here. Born in 1954, so I am currently 58 years old. I grew up in Syracuse and summered up on the St. Lawrence River and on Lake Ontario, so I'm an upstate New York kid. I moved to Hudson from Los Angeles, so there was a bunch of moving around in between. Let's see. I went to elementary school in Syracuse. I went to a private day school when we moved to Cazenovia, from sixth grade till 10th grade when I went to boarding school. Sort of never went back to Syracuse after boarding school. Moved to Boston and went to the museum school, School of the Museum of Fine Arts, and Tufts University.
Wow. At what age did you move to Boston?
Let's see. I moved to Boston when I was 19. And when I was 20, I met Deanie. And Deanie and I have been together for 38 years. We actually got married last year in the state of New York. We can't do it federally, but had our closest friends over and got married.
Wow, that's great.
Kind of unexpected legal maneuver that we thought we should make, because, you know, getting married after 38 years, it's not like it was a priority, but
it's nice to be able to.
Yeah, and certainly we hope, you know, would help with legal situations mm-hmm. later on.
So tell me, what did you think you wanted to do when you were a child? Like, what were your interests when you were a child and you were, say, in Syracuse or, you know, before,
right.
You know, when you were young?
Well, I always knew that I was different. I always had a sense of being gay, and so that did absolutely play into who I was. You know, I knew I didn't quite fit in. You know, I found out later that I actually did fit in, but when I was little, I thought I didn't. And I always had an interest in old houses, in architecture. Oddly enough, I didn't study to become an architect. I studied to become a sculptor. But I think being open to three-dimensional thinking in the art world has really helped me restore, renovate, and save 7 buildings. The first building being in Boston when I was, I think I started that one when I was probably 25 or 26 was the first house I bought a big Victorian house in Dorchester. My friends Dan and Karen bought that house. Dan Elias was the host of Antiques Roadshow. Karen Keene owned Skinner Auction House. Anyway, that was the first house.
And so did you ever have any formal training in renovating houses? Like you say, you studied sculpture, but you didn't study architecture. Did you, like, you know, work as a tradesperson? You know, like, what did you do?
Well,
carpentry? How did you get into the physicality?
I don't know. I think I've been surrounded by people that have always just been doers, and I just told myself I could do it and did it. My father never picked up a hammer or mowed a lawn, anything like that at all, ever. There were hardly any tools in the house. But it just sort of came naturally. A broken lamp, I'll fix the lamp. You know, I think my brother and I found a Victrola when we were kids on the street and fixed it. You know, it's just funny. I just liked doing it.
Wow. What did your father do? I mean, what sort of household, you know, what was your childhood home like?
He was a, you know, 8:30 to 5 o'clock businessman.
Mm-hmm.
So he went off to work. My mother did a lot of extracurricular activities. She was in a lot of different writing clubs and reading clubs and you know, did a lot of great work on her own, but she was a house mom. I mean, she was there for us, made lunch every day. You know, we came home from school for lunch. And I was surrounded by great neighbors and friends. There were a lot of kids my age in my neighborhood. We could play a game of kick the can with 40 kids. We could get those 40 kids together in 15 minutes just by running around the neighborhood. It was really pretty fabulous growing up in the 50s in Syracuse. Syracuse has suffered like Hudson hasn't. Downtown Syracuse is a ghost town. I know that Hudson was a ghost town for a while, but Syracuse is still on its way to being more of a ghost town. And Hudson, of course, is making huge strides, you know, being a popular destination. Mm. Syracuse is not a destination.
Yeah, that's something I want to get to talk to you about Hudson. But I guess now the next question I'd like to know is, how did you get from Boston to Hudson? Like, when were you first aware of Hudson? You know, you are from upstate New York, so you had a sense of the, you know, the lie of the land and the different towns. But yeah. How do you go from Boston? And what age did you go from Boston? And what prompted you to leave? This sounds like this gorgeous townhouse that you renovated.
Well, it's kind of funny. It had to do with sculpture, ceramic sculpture again, but. Let's see, from Boston, in Boston, Dean and I had a really fun rock band, and we did really well. We were on tour for 7 years. The band was called Human Sexual Response, and we had a couple of hit songs, one song called I Want to Be Jackie Onassis, and another song called What Does Sex Mean to Me. Recently, there's been a sort of a resurgence of the band's song, Land of the Glass Pine Cones, on college radio. So we were the 1980 unsigned college radio, best college radio band. So with unsigned meaning we never got a record deal, never made any money. But we could travel all over the country and play and sold out crowds. It was really, really fun. So when the band broke up in 1982, Deanie was working as a bartender at a club called Spit. And we went to visit a friend in Key West. Actually, my mother sent me on a trip to Key West to sort of take a little time off. And it was beautiful there. And I came back, and Deanie and I went down, visited a friend, and decided to move there and bought a completely ripped apart house from the city of Key West. It was next door to Calvin Klein's house. And we moved to Key West and renovated that house. It was kind of funny. Deanie one day went over next door to borrow a cup of underwear from Calvin Klein, who thought it was hysterical, thank God. But so we renovated that house, lived in Key West in the 80s. I kind of want to print up a T-shirt that says, I survived Key West in the 1980s. from Key West, we moved to Palisades, New York, Sneeden's Landing. We loved it there. We were there for about a year, but we really couldn't afford to buy a house there. New York Magazine had just done an article about that neighborhood, and it was so fabulous, and everyone added $1 million to the price of their homes. So at that point, we moved to Vermont, renovated a beautiful 250-year-old farmhouse. And when we finished the renovation, which took a year, this feeling crept in. We were in our 30s, and I thought, what are we going to do? You know, way out in the country, 135 acres in Vermont, when we finished renovating this house, let's think about putting it on the market and going back and seeing if this building is for sale that I used to love in P-Town. So, Provincetown. So we called Provincetown, and sure enough, the house was still for sale. So we put our house in Vermont on the market. I went on a trip with my parents up to Burlington. Deanie stayed at home. There's a train in the background. I love that sound.
Me too.
A couple from Los Angeles came to look at our house and bought it, paid full price on Monday with a check. So, done. But we hadn't found a place to buy in Provincetown, so we went and we made a really low ball offer on a house that I'd looked at in the 80s in P-Town. In P-Town, less than half the asking price, and they accepted it. So we got this really amazing house at the top of the highest hill right in the middle of downtown P-Town. And you could see all of Cape Cod from our house. It was ridiculously wonderful. And so now we're into the 90s. And really loved living there. But everyone, all of our friends, a lot of our friends were sick with AIDS. And a lot of people that got sick with AIDS decided if they were, you know, it was a death sentence then, or so we thought. They all moved to the Cape. If I'm going to die, let me spend my final months, you know, in Provincetown. Well, as we know, many of them ended up living, but certainly many did pass away. Dini created his character called Musty Chiffon to help raise money to support our friends with AIDS. Sorry.
That's okay.
It's still emotional.
Yeah. Living through that experience. Yeah. It was a hard time for...
And, you know, friends would move in and then pass away and their families would come and we'd have to deal with them. And it was an odd time. But anyways, Musty Chiffon was the character that Dini created. And Musty Chiffon would be part of these benefits, would just raise many, many thousands of dollars to support the Provincetown AIDS Support Group, which is now a huge organization, just really wonderful. But then, really, it was just three or four or five people. They were calling their nurse friends and arranging hospice visits and, you know, wheels on, we used to call it wheels, meals on heels, because they were delivered by drag queens. And just do whatever we could to make it through the winters and, you know, when no one was working. And in the summer, help cover for people that couldn't make it to work during those really important money-earning months of the summer. In the same time, renovated our house in Provincetown, and I did the same trick there that I'd done in other places. I made the back of the house more wonderful than the front of the house. Just sort of made, you know, houses for so many years functioned from the front, and the front porch was where you met with your neighbors and where you saw what was going on the street. Well, now, you know, of course, in our lifetime, who wants to look at the street anymore? We know there's going to be cars going by, and we don't necessarily want to talk to our neighbors all day, every day, because we're not out working in the fields or whatever, or on the river. Many of us are working from home. So I turn in Key West and in Boston and in Provincetown, I opened up the back of the house, completely just blew it open with huge windows and huge porches facing the back, and made that the living space, moving the kitchens to these big open rooms in the back. And now that's very popular family room sort of living, but then it really wasn't being done very much. And believe me, not that I created it. I just think that people's lifestyles changed. And so when we blew out the back of the house in Provincetown, we added a roof deck to the top of the house that could fit 150 people in 3 feet of snow, which was what I told the engineer that I needed it to do. And so we did have huge parties and many celebrities playing Provincetown would start at our July 4th party, sort of giving samples of what their show would be for the summer. So hundreds of people would come to our parties on July 4th in Provincetown. It was really a blast. And being at the highest point of Provincetown, the fireworks on July 4th were just unbelievable.
So why did you leave?
So
I'm sorry, yeah. I have to ask you.
Well, it was really great, and the 90s were winding down. I was waiting tables, and I would be working... You know, I would say I'm only going to work 5 days a week. And then before you knew it, I was working 7 days a week. And I worked in one of the few restaurants that stayed open during the winter. So I would work all summer and then I'd work all winter. And every month I'd say, let's take some time off next month and go, you know, let's go somewhere, let's do something. Work, work, work. And I don't know, we just all of a sudden, oh, I know what happened. Dini we went to visit some friends in Los Angeles and ran into this group of people that wanted Musty Chiffon to re-record our old Human Sexual Response hit song, I Want to Be Jackie Onassis, as a disco song. And so we did. So Musty Chiffon sang I Want to Be Jackie Onassis. Bob Esty, I keep getting confused because now in Hudson we have Etsy, the online craft store. But anyway, Bob Esty, who was Donna Summer's engineer, engineered the disco remix of Jackie O. And we had a blast doing it. And the people that had put it together were from Los Angeles. And so we were going back and forth to LA and visiting good friends there. And we decided, let's just move to Los Angeles. What are we doing? So we moved to Los Angeles. rented an apartment. And we had so many things that we'd collected over the years. So we gave a lot of things to friends and neighbors and family and sold off a bunch of stuff. There was one day, Dini said, I'm going to have a yard sale. And I said, but we don't really have anything to yard sale away. You know, it's, you know, either it's junk or I want to keep it. And Dini managed to find stuff in cupboards and closets. And, you know, I didn't really notice anything and moved, and he made like $7,000 in an afternoon yard sale. Anyway, so much for those things you think you can't do without. So we moved to Los Angeles and lived in a two-bedroom apartment. And after a year, I mean, it was a fun year, but it was a year that I just don't like living in a city. I can't see very well. So if we went out, you know, I was prepared by Luz Dini. It's not like you can walk out and hail a cab. And I just really didn't like Los Angeles very much. And we did know some nice people, but they didn't connect with the other nice people that we knew. There just didn't seem to be any sort of sense of community in Los Angeles that we had so much of in Boston, in those wonderful Boston years, and in Provincetown. There was such a sense of community, and it just didn't exist in Los Angeles. And so we weren't even thinking about moving. We came to visit our friend Elaine in Hudson. This is how I'm bringing it back to Hudson now. Elaine Beaufay, an old Boston friend, had moved to Hudson, and she was doing a show of her ceramics in Spencertown. And I was always familiar with the Hudson Valley and how wonderful it was, so we decided we'd come and visit Elaine and see her show. Her show is fabulous. She's still doing ceramic sculpture, and it's really beautiful. But meanwhile, she drove us into downtown Hudson to eat at what is now Red Dot. It was called Raymakers then. And we just fell in love with the town. We drove down Warren Street, and things were boarded up in these spectacular buildings. And we, I kind of went crazy to move here. Dini is not, he puts up with my renovations. He loves me very much. So we ended up buying a building here in Hudson and opening the Hudson River Theater. We, an old department store right on Warren Street in the 500 block. The bottom floor we rented out as an antique store. The second floor was a theater, and the third floor was our huge loft apartment. And it was a lot of fun. it was hard though, because we started out as a children's puppet theater. I sort of left out the whole puppet thing. Our good friend Caleb Fulham was a fabulous puppeteer. And whenever I could, I would assist him in his shows. We did shows in Key West with him. We did shows in Boston with him. Boston Puppet Showplace in Brookline Village. And what was he going to say about Caleb? Puppets. Oh, so we opened a children's puppet theater because we were semi-retired. We didn't want to work that much, but we thought on Saturday afternoons and Sunday afternoons we could have puppet shows and, you know, 100 kids and parents and whatever. Not one person ever came to those puppet shows. And we had puppeteers from all over the country. Incredible puppeteers that, you know, are famous everywhere except for Hudson. And we brought 100 tickets to the library for them to hand out. They never handed one out. It was very frustrating. So we recognized very quickly that there were a lot of artists living here. And we had a lot of performance artist friends, a lot of drag queen friends, there's the ice cream truck going by. drag queen friends, musician friends from our old rock band days, and just a wide variety of acts that we knew. So we decided to start booking them, but to we needed a liquor license. So we very quickly got a liquor license, and very quickly we're sitting on top of Hudson's very successful disco every Saturday night. So every Saturday night we are in charge of all of Hudson's drinking. And then we lived upstairs. So we had actually, without knowing it, walked into La Cage aux Folles, and we were living it, like it or not.
Can I ask, what year was this? When did you move to Hudson, and when did you...
Okay, so
you
know, moved to Hudson.
The puppet theater first, and then it turned into a disco.
Yeah, we moved here in 2000.
Oh, that recently?
Yeah, so 12 years ago now. And it took us... Well, the building was completely in ruin. The third floor was open to the elements and the birds. I put millions of bird carcasses into a dumpster. probably a year after we bought the building, we opened. And the opening was incredible. All of our new friends in Hudson, I mean, there is certainly a sense of community in Hudson that we are lacking in Los Angeles. The final day before the theater opened, all of our new friends in Hudson were there helping us, finishing with the painting and sweeping and mopping and, you know, setting things up and hanging the curtains for the stage and, you know, arranging the seating, and everyone was helping. It was really a blast. And so that turned out to be pretty amazing. At the same time, the pressures in Hudson... There was a lot of pressure in Hudson between old-timers and newcomers. At least I think that's what some of the... How do I say it? There are some people here that are really invested in the poverty of Hudson. They make their money off of poverty in Hudson. Whether they're skimming welfare money or whether they're getting a percentage of grants that they get to help people on welfare, or just people that have gotten very used to living off of poor people. And when we moved here, they were fighting over a cement plant, whether or not to build the largest cement plant in the world, a stone's throw from where this house is, right back there, or not. It absolutely would have destroyed this beautiful town that's still standing. Most of the towns in Upper New York State have been torn down. Hudson is still standing, and it's spectacular. It would have been just horrible. All of the doctors in the hospital said anyone with a child with respiratory problems, which, you know, anyone with children now knows that most children have respiratory problems, would have to leave the area. I mean, how could you build a plant and tell your children they have to leave the area? It just seemed so wrong on so many levels, but it was being forced down the throats of everyone who lived here. And fortunately, there were some people that really came up against it. Sam Pratt is the number one person on the top of the pedestal that really just fought it and fought it and fought it. And so there was a lot of us against them feeling perpetrated by the local paper, the Register Star. Love the whole us against them. I think it made for good news stories. But it was really a lot of the people that grew up here were against it too. So it really wasn't us against them as much as it was educated against non-educated. Or maybe certain people were promised certain things if they allowed the plant to be built. You know, I can't prove that money went into anybody's pockets, but people that knew perfectly well it was a bad thing were saying it was a good thing. In fact, for a while there was even somebody who was in a very prominent position in Hudson right now, our mayor, going from door to door telling people that the plant would actually clean the air. I mean, it's just very strange. So there was that struggle going on, and we opened up and had huge crowds of people, and one Saturday night, Hudson is the first place I've ever been called a faggot, by the way, I should say that. But one Saturday night, we were full. Kate Pearson from the B-52s was performing that night. Our friend Galen Dorsey was at that time she was David Bowie's bass player. Maggie Moore were performing that night. The place was packed. And a group of thugs came in and up the stairs. Remember, the theater was on the second floor, and they stood in this stairwell screaming faggot, and they were pissing on the walls and on the stairs. And they pulled up in a car that we could see from the front was a huge window. We could see their car, and we could see their license plate, and we could see all of them. There were, well, I mean, our capacity was 77, but I would say there were about 150 of us looking down at them. And so we could identify them, and I called the police. I wouldn't let anyone come in or go out, so they were stuck in the stairs. They couldn't come into the theater, but no one in the theater could go and deal with them either, because it would have been, you know, there would have been a fight, and I didn't want anyone to start fighting. So I called the police, and I called the police, and I called the police. And finally, after about half an hour, these thugs left. The police never came. I kept calling them all night long. They never came. The next day, I went to the police station, and the police told me that it was our fault. You know, who did we think we are, thinking we can move into this town and draw a crowd of people, and they're not to be a problem? Like, well, there isn't a problem. I mean, these thugs were creating a problem. Here's their license number. I can give you a complete description of what they look like, and we probably have photographs of them. And they basically yelled at me, called me a faggot, and told me to get out of the police station. So at that moment, I realized I am either going to make this my life's fight, or I'm not going to do this anymore. And I didn't want to spend my life fighting with the Hudson Police Department. So now what do we do with this successful nightclub, this meticulously restored building, with this beautiful apartment? Let's sell it. And we couldn't really find a buyer. It took months and months and months, and now going into a year and a half, and we finally worked a deal to trade our restored building for this ruin of a house. But this house is a fabulous house. And I really wanted it, but it was a stupid deal. But at the same time, an incredible house. So at that time, our best friend, puppeteer Caleb Fulham, was dying of stomach cancer. And I said, Caleb, what should I do? This is just ridiculous. You know, this beautiful restored building, 9,000 square feet on Warren Street, trading for this ruin of a house, you know, 8,000 square feet, no income potential. We hadn't thought of the B&B yet. And almost the last thing he said to me was, think of the adventure. And it was, I miss him so much to this day. And it was such good advice. And we did the trade, and I've never looked back. It was the perfect thing to do. The first night that Dean and I slept in here, the house was completely in ruin. We slept in an air mattress in the library. And every room was built with a bathroom. And every room is separated by a foot-thick brick wall. And in the middle of the night, I sat up and I'm like, bed and breakfast. We're the perfect bed and breakfast. And so we worked on it for a year, opened up. And within the next year, the New York Times had done a huge feature article on us, and we've been full ever since. So that's a really long answer of how do we come to Hudson.
Yeah, but it's a wonderful story. And just what your friend said, Caleb said, you know, like, it's an adventure.
Yeah, yeah.
That's really some of the best advice that anybody, you know, yeah. Think of it as an adventure.
I was raised with a Methodist, going to Methodist Sunday school, but my mother was pretty much of an atheist, and my dad was a believer, so I was raised, you know, you decide. Mm-hmm. And it's always worked for me to, you know, do unto others kind of thinking, and keep yourself open to whatever might come your way, spiritually. And the weirdest thing, you know, sometimes you really struggle with something. You can't get something to work. And no matter what you do, it doesn't work. Well, I'd be in the basement trying to sister a beam to hold up underneath the kitchen where an old dishwasher had rotted through. And I'd get everything into position. and realize, oh, I don't have a nail. And right there on the beam in front of my eyes was a nail, the perfect nail, you know, or just something else would happen and within reach would be exactly what I needed. It was weird. This house just kept doing that over and over again. And every time I say, thank you, Caleb. But it just, it's worked out very well. Worked out so well that now we're almost done. And we're wondering, what next?
Have you thought about what next? I mean, would you actually leave this place, or would you keep this and try some, you know, keep it on and try something else in Hudson? Would you stay in Hudson?
Well, it's kind of amazing. I really love Hudson. I love where it is geographically. I mean, you can get here from anywhere really easily, and you can go here anywhere from here really easily. And I'm seeing friends that I haven't seen in years and years because they just happen to be going through Hudson. This is a very big, expensive house. I think if we stopped being a bed and breakfast, it would be smarter to move into a smaller house. But I love this house, so I'm not sure about that. When we moved to Hudson, one of the first things we got involved with was this fight against the cement plant. But at the same time, we were part of an organization called Fourth Down. And that was to promote businesses below 4th Street. Because below 4th Street, there was nothing except for what is now the Red Dot. So Alana and Perry were very instrumental into putting together this Fourth Down organization and some other really key players in there. Lisa Durfee, who has a vintage clothing store called Five and Diamond. Just a bunch of other people, and it was a blast. And Musty was the MC of the first Fourth Down fashion show. And we really, it was a blast. We auctioned off vintage clothing and made something like $14,000. You know, everyone thought we'd make, you know, $800 or something. So with that money, we threw a street fair right out in front of Red Dot. And it was just to bring people down below 4th Street because no one would ever go there. Well, now they have Second Down or sort of below Third Organization, and the, you know, and now they're trying to bring people above 7th Street. So I mean, all of Hudson is really cooking now. I mean, it's so different and it's really great. So we would be smart to stay here for a little bit longer because we're always moving out of places just before the property values go through the roof. So we should try and stick around. And again, I do love it here. So, and I don't know where else I would go at this point. And there's a sense of community. I love my friends here.
Yeah, who do you consider your community here? I mean, yeah. Who are your friends? Who are your community? Like on a daily basis, who do you interact with? I mean, you run a B&B, so you have interesting people coming through.
Yeah,
they're not from here usually. I assume.
Right.
So, you know, who is your community? Who is your day to day interactions in Hudson?
Well, I think the people that I see most day to day, a lot of them are the people that I first met, or people that we met when we first moved here. So Bob, Monica Meckling. Bob is currently doing all the graphics for Club Helsinki. We go to Club Helsinki a bunch. In fact, our band is doing a reunion there in November after 33 years. and we go to their teat a lot. And I think Bob does a barter system, so Bob and Monica are there a lot too. So we run into them quite often, and we speak almost daily. And they watch The Inforce when we go away as well. Nick and Carrie Haddad, you know, they were real pioneers in this town too. They came in and bought buildings when no one else wanted them. And, you know, they have apartments, a lot of lovely apartments for people in Hudson, which is a good thing because there are a lot of crappy apartments, you know, and that should not be. Apartments should be nice. So Nick and Carrie are friends, David and Fail. Fail Green, David Sharp. Fail does a lot of, she has the, I have to remember the name of her opera company.
It's okay.
Most of our friends are very involved in the community. David Petrovsky is another favorite who we first met when we moved here. I think he's part of this project, actually. I think he's one of the interviewers.
Yes. I've been talking to David a lot. He's lovely. He's wonderful. Yes.
He's really great. And he's always been interested in antiques. And anything since he was a kid, he's been working with antiques. And I can really relate to that too, because the same thing with old houses and you know, some of the furniture left of them, I've always just been so interested in. You know, I don't have to own it. I just like to see it. It's not really important that I own it, although sometimes it is important to own it if I want to fix it up. So people that I hang out with, Vince Mulford, Antiques over on Warren Street, he has one of the best eyes I think I've ever... The things, if he appreciates something and puts it in his shop, usually I love everything that he has, but if I don't love it, it to me it means, oh, I have to look at that from another direction, because if he likes it, it must be incredible, and I have to find out what's incredible in it. He can convince me that something is beautiful that I didn't think was beautiful before. So it's, that's kind of funny. So I always kind of go in there, and as I'm talking to him, I'm glancing around the room for something that I need convincing on. Learning, I guess. There's a wide variety. I'm sure I'm not mentioning my best friends. Well, I already mentioned Elaine Buffet, the ceramic sculptor, and she does bookkeeping around Hudson as well, so she gets around a little bit.
How has the community changed, like, in the 12 years that you've been here? And earlier you mentioned, like, the old-timers versus the newcomers. And, you know, against the factory that was going up. Has the dynamic changed? Are the old-timers, you know, are they less rigid about what they don't want to see happen here? What's the vibe here?
Yeah, now? I think that we're slowly but surely learning that the vibe isn't what we were told it was by the local paper, that it isn't us against them. I think early on there was a resistance, who can afford to eat in those New York City restaurants? And, you know, slowly but surely people are realizing, we can just go to one of those restaurants and have a beer. You know, we can even actually go and have a burger and a beer. you know, they're not, you know, you don't have to order all the expensive things. And more people that have lived here all their lives are coming using Warren Street again, you know, they used when they were kids. There is this sort of unfounded belief that there's a lot of crime in downtown Hudson, and there just isn't. I mean, yeah, there is some, but not a lot. I mean, it's a city. But the dynamic that's really changed is all the sort of the... I hate to say gay people, because it's not all gay people. So the hipsters, let's just say, some of them from the city and some of them not, that were part of our crowd when we first moved here in 2000, 2001 and 2, that would fill the Hudson River Theater every Saturday night, fill the dance floor. That crowd used to fit into one room. And now that crowd doesn't fit into one room anymore. So we can't have everybody do everything anymore. So we've sort of had to fragment out into different groups, which I think happens in any community, and probably with age if you stay in one community long enough. but it's been an interesting dynamic in Hudson, because the word used to go out. Well, in fact, we did so much together that we used to all agree, let's not do anything on Tuesday night. And we would all tell each other, nothing on Tuesday night. And then, you know, someone would say, oh, but I have my best friend coming into town and I wanted to introduce her to everyone on Tuesday night. Can't you all come over on Tuesday? We're like, oh, great. Thanks a lot. Now we want to have it one night off this week. You know, we'd party through Tuesday night. So in one way, it's quieter. In another way, it's bigger. But back to the old-timers thing, there's a strange dynamic with having a bed and breakfast. A lot of the people that grew up in Hudson and moved away in the 60s and 70s when Hudson was really down, are now coming back to bury their uncles or, you know, to go to a high school reunion or things like that. And I'd say it's about 50-50, with 50% of them saying, oh, we were told about all these great changes, and we've been told what a wonderful town Hudson is, and we've read in the New York Times about Hudson, or we've seen in Travel and Leisure, or you know, a house featured in some magazine, or on a blog or something. And then the other 50% say, wow, can you believe the change? I mean, no one from their hometown that they've talked to even mentioned the 40 restaurants or the, you know, which to me is just weird. But I mean, I know in Syracuse, if some huge industry like tourism has done to Hudson, if some huge industry moved into Syracuse, someone that I still know there would mention it. But Hudson gets visited, back to being a B&B, people from Denmark, China, from all over the world are coming here and just loving it. And then you have people in Greenport saying, oh, I don't know what you'd want to go down on Warren Street for. So there's this strange disconnect going on here that, you know, I can't figure out, nor do I care to. You know, the history here is just magnificent. And right now we're watching the Fergery Boat Club be closed down. It's a bunch of shacks along the Hudson River, the North Dock. They've had, you know, private do not trespass signs up there for years. I mean, since I've moved here, and I'm sure years before, we've always just gone down anyway and, you know, walked right by the signs and looked around. And I just thought it was really wonderful. But at the same time, those signs were, you know, not very wonderful, and I have heard about people being chased out. But I did recognize that they were really old fishing shacks and represented a way of life that we don't really see on the Hudson River anymore. They're on land that sort of nobody owned, right below the sewage treatment plant. So not only it wasn't really owned, but no one really wanted to own it either. Well, as it turns out, I guess the state owned it, and the state now has turned it over to the city, and the city has decided that it's too much to, it's too big of a risk to have people living on city property that don't have sewer systems. You know, they're basically boathouses suspended over the river, you know, in these mud flats. I understand the city's position that it's too dangerous to have any city property being used that way. But at the same time, it seems that for many, many years in Hudson, there has been a movement that is not proud of the history here and does not care about the history here. And it's torn down a couple of hotels that we could really use right now. And generally just doesn't recognize the historic value of the area. And I think if there was any us against them, it would be the people that understand the importance of history in general and the people that don't understand the importance of history in general. That would be the only us against them that I see really played out day to day. I don't know what the answer with the Fergery Boat Club would be, because I understand that they did not take the proper steps, and I don't know what those steps would have been, to stay there, and now they're being thrown out. In fact, a fence went up there today, and the people that have always claimed ownership to those shacks can no longer even go in them. I hope they leave up the shacks I hope it could be some sort of a fishing museum. I mean, there's a fireman's museum here. It could be a fishing museum. You can't fish for shad anymore in the Hudson River. But certainly that's why these cities along the Hudson are here, you know, a big part of why they're here. You know, it's an odd thing to see something that we still are one of our only connections with the river. And now it's just going to be, they say, a parking lot. I don't know. I would hate to see those, all the shacks just go away and that be that without any, I mean, people are photographing them as much as they can, but a photograph can only tell you so much.
Yeah, and it seems to me that if they were left standing, even just as, you know, historical, you know, buildings and documents, it would balance the town, balance the city, because, yeah, it is part of its heritage.
Yeah. And that's it's the same sort of heritage, or it's coming from the same direction as the people that were working on the river. Not the people necessarily that owned the boat, you know, the ferries, or owned the factories, but the people that were working on the river in smaller boats and throwing their own nets and bringing fish and selling it themselves. And at the same time, in other areas of the city, trying to save workers' houses, because, you know, of course, this is a big grand house built by some rich person. And just, you know, equal to this, on a few blocks away, on the opposite side of Warren Street, there's some very simple, but in my mind, very elegant houses that were owned by people that worked in the factories. Yes, they were probably people that worked in the factories that were managers of their departments or whatever, but certainly not the owners of the factories. I mean, small, simple houses with beautiful, beautiful lines, and really important to save, to show an example of every style of living. Just because someone might have lived in a bigger, fancier house doesn't make that house, in my mind, more value historically than much simpler workers' housing. There's some houses up on Worth Avenue across from the entrance to the prison that are just bam, 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 bam in a row. Nine houses all connected, and they're, you know, all two floors, and they're just beautiful to me. But there are many people that wouldn't see any reason to save them at all. You know, it's a different way of looking at things, I guess.
What do you think is going to happen in Hudson in the next few years about with this battle between, you know, people wanting to preserve and, you know, keep this history and, you know, architectural heritage alive, and people who don't? Do you think, you know, does Hudson, you know, do the people in Hudson actually communicate with each other very well and discuss these, and how is that dynamic? How do you think it's going to play out?
Yeah, it's a big issue. It's a big issue, and it gets complex, because now, do you save things? In what shape do you save things? Some people renovate things to the point of being a new building. You know, it only exists where the old building was, and it has windows where the old building has windows, and everything else is new. I mean, that's one approach that's going on in Hudson right now. You know, time will tell. You know, the glass is half full for me. I tend to always be on the bright side, and I believe that right will prevail. Hudson is doing very well because tourists are coming here, and tourism is our number one industry. I can't imagine that the people in the business of poverty would win out, because there's no goal. You know, we can't say, we have $64 million of welfare pumping through Hudson right now. We're aiming at $65 million by next year. You know, that obviously that's not a conversation that would happen. But you can say, you know, we're our tourist dollars. We've made $87 million from tourists this year. We're looking at $89 next year. You know, that would be a positive conversation. So I believe that right will prevail. But certainly the growing pains are being felt right now. And I think that if I grew up in Hudson and I lived in an inexpensive apartment, and I saw that those tourists wanted to rent my apartment for more money than I'm paying, I would be nervous and I would be angry because I would feel like I was being forced out by the people that can afford to travel. But at the same time, my children would be getting jobs, and you know, if they wanted to work in restaurants or if they wanted to work on in an office level, you know, promoting the area, if they wanted to work. There are so many jobs that open up when you have money coming through a town, as I'm sure you know. But I think that if those that can understand the issues can convince people without jobs that they might enjoy those jobs and their children might enjoy those jobs, then they would maybe get off the welfare cycle that they're on now. Because there are jobs. I think unemployment in Hudson is very, very low. You know, time will tell. Certainly the growing pains, it's awful to watch. The city decided in all their wisdom to call us a commercial property. We're in a residential neighborhood. According to state law, 5 rooms or less in a residential neighborhood, owner-occupied, bed and breakfast, gets a residential assessment code. Well, ours was changed to a commercial code this year. You can't have a commercial business in a residential neighborhood. So the next step would be to close us down. We fought it, and I like to be kind of a quiet person, but we made a lot of noise on all the local blogs and all the, you know, because this is the first time an assessor has reached into a hat of commercial assessment codes in a residential neighborhood. So they wisely, because we hired a good lawyer, decided to switch it back. So we are now residentially coded in our residentially zoned neighborhood once again. But, you know, it just never stops. So, would I move away or not? I love it here. But at some point, you get sick of the struggle. You know, maybe we'd move somewhere outside of town. But then again, we wouldn't be able to walk, which I love doing. You know, whatever happens, I can just walk home.
Yeah, I think that is one of the major benefits of Hudson. I've only been here for a few days, but just the accessibility of it, the walkingness of it, I can't wait to, you know, have a bit more time to just go exploring it on foot. And I think it makes for a really beautiful, livable place.
It does. Our friend Sarah Sterling says, if you want to get somewhere in Hudson, drive. Because if you walk, you're just going to see all these people and you're never going to get there. She's really correct. We could really use a grocery store, though.
Within walking distance.
Within walking distance, yeah. I mean, the farm market is really great. And most of us have some vegetables growing in our backyards, and it's really funny because, you know, like every other town, during zucchini season, everyone's trying to give zucchinis to everyone else.
Or tomatoes or basil.
Lettuce, yeah. But being a bed and breakfast, that's a great thing because we use it all.
Yes. And I have read wonderful reviews about your bread and breakfast.
Oh, thanks.
You know, like just, you know, I did a tiny little bit of research and it's like, wow.
You know,
people who come here really, really appreciate it. So it sounds like you put on a lovely...
Well, it's fun. I think there are 13 bed and breakfasts in Hudson now. And we're still turning away about 1,000 people a month. The fact that there is not a major hotel here is absolutely... because the people who are in the business of property are the people giving out the numbers to potential investors. You know, there's at some point Hudson's going to catch a break. I'm hoping it's not a chain hotel. I would like some fabulous designer to build, you know, a 50 to 100 room hotel in Hudson. I was really hoping that it could be on the corner of 5th and Warren Street. Now I understand there's going to be a grocery store there, so that's great. But I wish that some of the people looking into building low-income housing, that as I understand it, they're going to have to import people into Hudson to fill up that low-income housing, that they would build a hotel instead that would employ people, because we need a hotel. We're turning away 1,000 people a month. And I'm being and I'm really underestimating when I say 1,000 people a month. Just us, just the Enid Hudson, we turn away 100 people a week. We're turning away 15 to 20 people a day. It's really crazy. But, you know, I don't want to build hotels, so there's not much more I can say about it.
Well, one of my, you know, summing up kind of questions was going to be, well, so what would you like to see happen in Hudson? But I think a hotel and a, you know, and a market, a grocery store nearby would be...
A hotel and a grocery store. And if we could somehow open up another area of the waterfront, we could call after call after call from people coming up or down the river in a boat. And they want to pull in somewhere. And they the Powerboat Association does let people tie up there. That has happened quite often. They can't get someone on the phone, or they're told they're full. I'd love to see Hudson's relationship with the river open back up again. You know, I do remember the 60s in the Hudson Valley, and I do know that the Hudson River really smelled really bad. And no one wanted to live on the river or be anywhere near it. And in the early 70s, or in the 70s, that's when they built all the apartment buildings along the river that is now, I don't know if it's considered low-income housing or just not expensive housing. Now the people want to live on the river. It's sort of unfortunate that the whole city's cut off from the river by the low-income housing. Actually, I think it is low-income housing. Mm-hmm. And as I understand it, the powers that be just signed another 30-year lease on those apartments. So it'll be another 30 years before Hudson has a chance to, you know, take back the river. But I hope when they have the chance, they do.
Okay, another, like, summing up kind of question. Well, I've got two, but the first one is, okay, is there anything else that you would like to talk about in relation to, like, this life history of you and you know, your how you feel living in Hudson? Is there anything that you can think of that you would like to talk about?
Sure.
That we haven't got to yet?
Well, I do. You know, earlier I said Hudson is the first place that I was ever called a faggot. And, you know, you go through your life as a... I've been openly out since I was 19. And I'm 58 now, so I've certainly been in other situations where I heard people think it, but Hudson was the first place where somebody actually yelled it out. But I also have to say that it's a non-issue here. Most of the people that I've met in Hudson, I would almost say all the people that I've met in Hudson, I didn't meet the people driving by in the car yelling faggot.
Hello. We're going to the river. We'll be right back.
Okay.
Cool.
You still going?
Yeah, we're going to do it in 5 or 10 minutes. I think okay. We're just winding up.
Being gay is such a non-issue that, yes, we were involved in the Pride Parade this year, but I almost feel like it's unnecessary. I mean, it's so accepted in this area. Being gay is so accepted in this area that I feel it's a non-issue. So I almost feel bad about saying that Hudson's the only place I was ever called a faggot. but at the same time, it is. I'm trying to think if there was something else.
I guess, I mean, something else that I would like to ask then in relation to that. Yeah. Like, you know, you made a conscious decision not to engage with the Hudson police and pursue the fact that they, right. You know, weren't going to take, you know, be, you know, take, come to your defense when you were kind of being attacked, verbally attacked, and your, you know, your friends, your people in your club were being intimidated.
Yeah.
How has that relationship developed? I mean, because you are innkeepers here, you are, you know, members of the community in a commercial sense.
Yeah.
How is your relationship with the Hudson police? Have you had any issues since then?
Well, at the time that it happened, I really kind of understood that that was one person talking, one police officer being really frustrated. I think that he knew the kids, And I think he knew that if he could talk to those kids, he could teach them. But if he were to arrest them, that would just make them more resistant. And I can understand that. I wish he'd just said that to me. Instead, he was just reacting with anger and telling me to get the fuck out of his, you know, faggot, get the fuck out of my face. So it was his choice of words. And if I wasn't willing to go to battle with someone for a bad choice of words at a very, you know, it's 7 o'clock in the morning or whatever it was. So I didn't feel that fighting was the thing to do at the time. But now I don't think about it really. Very quickly after that, I got over it. I knew I didn't want to have a nightclub. I didn't want to own a liquor license, but I kind of already knew that before that happened. I'm like, what have we done? I'd much rather go to the party and leave it when I want to. the Hudson Police Department does go round and round. And I've never thought about, it's another funny thing about Hudson, I've never been a political person. I mean, yes, I did, you know, I have always voted for the liberal candidate. So, I mean, I'm political in terms of my vote. I always vote. But at Hudson, day to day, you know, I'm paying attention to what's going on. So that's very new for me. Mm. Although getting old now because it's 12 years.
Mm. Yeah, and you'd have a real sense of the continuity and how the nuances and how
right.
things have changed. And also, you know the town so well that, you know, these issues as they come up, you understand how they fit. You would understand how they fit within the fabric.
And I know the players because when we had the bar, I got to know everybody. So, you know, I know the players. And I have to say that when the assessor changed our assessment code to commercial, out of the blue, I went to speak with the mayor, and he was not helpful at all. And I thought, geez, I thought we'd made some progress, but we haven't made any. He didn't help me at all, and then he never returned any of my 3 or 4 emails or phone calls after that. So I was a little frustrated by that. But then again, I had supported Nick Haddad for mayor, who would have been a great mayor. He's a fantastic businessman, and it's what Hudson needs right now. Anyway, maybe in the future.
Okay, one final question, and this is, again, any other issue that you want to talk about. Is there anyone else or who you know that you think that should be interviewed for this project? Since you've been in Hudson for 12 years, you know the town, you know
yeah.
a lot of the people. Can you suggest people that we should try and approach and ask if they would like to become a part of the archive?
Absolutely, Carrie Haddad. I would say Nick. Nick grew up in this area, grew up in Red Hook.
Mm-hmm.
But Carrie, because Carrie came to Hudson and opened an art gallery. And so she's really been on Warren Street. Not to say that Nick hasn't, but Carrie's really been in more in the trenches,
mm-hmm.
and I think she'd be a really good interview. I'm sure there's others that I think of. Well, I'm hoping that you're talking with Sam Pratt, although he doesn't live in Hudson anymore. I mean, he lives just outside of Hudson, but he's still very involved in Hudson. I think he has an office in Hudson.
What does he do? Like, what is his, what is his business or professional?
He was a writer.
Oh, okay.
And is a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see his blog, sampratt.com.
Okay.
And also Carol Ostrink. Have you talked to her? She has Gossips of Rivertown, which is my daily read, and without it, I go nuts. And, you know, she posts usually twice a day on a really good day, 3 or 4 times.
Is she the lady who talks about the architectural stuff that's going on
yes.
around town? Oh, I met
yeah.
her briefly at the farmer's market.
Yeah, she is fantastic.
Yes.
Yeah.
My host, I'm being hosted by Tom DiPietro and his wife Dorothy.
Yeah.
And they, Dorothy introduced me to her. And I think Dorothy is the same thing. Like, she follows that blog religiously.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes. And, was so involved, in how relevant what she's saying is to the community and the architect. Yeah, so.
Yeah. And then I'm going to say something that probably everyone else would say not to, but Tom Swope. Tom Swope is working with Eric Calloway for the Galvin. Basically, they have the house with the huge columns, three doors down. They're the guys that I bought this house from. And they're the ones that they own 47 buildings, including the library and the armory and the, you know, some really important buildings around Hudson, and they're doing huge renovations and very Disney-esque approach. And Tom is their spokesperson. Tom is a went to Harvard. He's a very smart guy who's representing a person that a lot of people see as sort of an enemy, because Galvin's group is building the low-income housing that we don't need. And so that would be a controversial interview. I think that would be good, because you should get two sides of a story.
Exactly, and that's what oral history projects are about. They're about illuminating what's going on and talking to people who don't, you know, quite often, you know, they want to talk to people who don't have a voice.
Right.
But you need to include it all so then people can listen to it and make up their own minds. It's not a right and a wrong. So that's a really good idea. Thank you for the suggestion.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, the more rounded a portrait of the time, the more interesting it's going to be.
Right.
Yeah, and nothing is black and white in it. In any kind of community, there's shades of gray everywhere, and there's good and there's bad within every organization or person. So that's a really good idea.
And the Fergie Boat Club. Yes. I mean, I wish there was an obvious solution for it, because there is not an obvious solution, it's going to be bulldozed. You know, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, I do know we're looking at talking to people involved with that. So that's something that's, you know, happening now in the next couple of weeks. So at least we can do something by documenting what is going on and how people are feeling about it.
Right.
You know, particularly the ones who, you know, whose families have been, you know, had their places there and now they've been, you know, locked out. So that will be an interesting.
Right.
Very, very interesting.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. This has been very interesting for me. It's really illuminated, you know, Hudson in a way that, you know, it's such a luxury to talk to a local.
The good, the bad, and the ugly.
Well, yeah. Yeah. No, but thank you. Thank you for giving your time and agreeing to this. It's a real gift. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, I'm going to turn this off now.